And let's get started. Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program today, the long-awaited corruption probe into law enforcement capture gets underway today. More than 80% of young South Africans earn less than 6,000 rand a month. New security requirements set to change how e-hailing firms operate. And a 40-city AI hackathon launches to embed African voices in global technology. It's Wednesday, the 17th of September. Now, the Madlanga Commission has begun public hearings into alleged criminal capture and political interference in South Africa's law enforcement system. It's a process, as you know, sparked by the KwaZulu-Natal Police Commissioner and Nhlanhla Mkhwanazi's bombshell allegations in July, and all of that under intense scrutiny. So, on a broader canvas, what is at stake here? What could realistically change, and where might all of this land? With me with a view is Kevin Malunga, who heads the law school at Regenesis Education. Kevin, let's start with this. The broad terms of reference, do you think they are focused enough to produce real findings, or maybe too wide to actually matter?
Good afternoon. Yes, it is afternoon. Afternoon, Jeremy, to you and the listeners. The terms of reference actually are appropriate. They could have been far wider, and it then would have been a 3, 4, 5 year commission. As you can imagine, it says the commission must investigate and report on the veracity, scope, and extent of allegations that law enforcement intelligence have been infiltrated by criminal syndicates. So that's the bird's eye view. And of course, you remember that. At issue here are SA Police Services, the Political Killings Task Team, the Joburg, Ekurhuleni and Tshwane Metro Police, NPA, Judiciary, and National Executive, etc. So I think the terms of reference are fine. The question is whether it will be enough within 3 months to be able to handle such a big elephant. It's a really big elephant. If I give you an example, Jeremy, let me personalize it and talk about things that I know about. When I was Deputy Public Protector, and of course, and Thuli, Advocate Thuli, now Professor, was the Public Protector, we were tasked with investigating state capture, right? And then, of course, again, the elephant too big. And what we then said was, we recommended to the president at the time, who was Jacob Zuma, that a commission of inquiry would be appropriate or more apposite under the Commissions Act of 1947. And that was technically a success in terms of the fact that commissions have more resources. Of course, South Africans may quibble and not be happy with my perception of that, because it went over $1 billion, if I recall. But the idea is that the mandate is good. The mandate is good. It will establish a general picture to the president. But what I suspect, and what I do suspect, and I don't want to preempt any findings, Jeremy, is that they probably will find that this is a much, much bigger hornet's nest than thought. And if so, then how do you then take it forward? Because as you know, in terms of the Commissions Act of 1947, ultimately these are advisory commissions. Of course, they've got full powers of inquiry to summon witnesses, retrieve documents. And of course, there's also a lot of commission fatigue. Currently, the budget is about 147.9 million. But given past precedent, will this be enough? So there's always those kind of dynamics. But in terms of the mandate, I think the drafters did the best they could.
So, Kevin, let me ask you this. How is the commission going to be able to expose interference without straying too deeply into policing decisions?
They have no choice, Jeremy. I think this is, you know, the standard investigative practice around the world, Jeremy, is you ask three questions. The first question is, what happened in the case? And this is standard investigative protocol all over the world. You ask what happened, right? And this is what General Mukwana is alleging has happened, and that he's saying people are so corrupt, they are colluding with criminals, etc. The second question is, what should have happened? What does the law say? And what is the ideal for a proper South African police system to work? And then the third and last thing, Jeremy, is what is the remedy? If the difference between what happened and what should have happened constitutes irregularities, corruption, etc., as General Mukwana has said, is how do you then remedy it? So I do believe that the question then is largely a political will issue, because, you know, when we've traveled, I've been fortunate enough to be trained by the Singaporeans, by the Koreans, and visited the Japanese and people like that on this very sector, and they all realize that their success comes down to political will,
right?
Because ultimately, the president might find the likelihood, and as I said, I don't want to preempt anything, but what if a report is saying that his mates or his political allies are doing very dodgy things? He will have to be decisive. So earlier on today, I was asked about the Marikana Commission, which I was involved in with Justice Madlanga when he was evidence leader. And the fatigue from that is that there were these wonderful recommendations and findings which have not been implemented,
right,
or at least implemented seriously.
Which, Kevin Malunga, goes to the whole issue of remedy. And let me ask you this very quickly. Time is against us. If serving officials are implicated, what immediate levers then exist? Is it suspension, prosecution, disciplinary action? And who acts swiftly in that respect?
Number one, the main man himself. So I think here he's actually strengthening his hand. I'm sure he knows what he wants to do, but then he obviously doesn't want this an arbitrary situation where he would take, you know, fire people without due process. The one thing that, and I'm going to say something slightly controversial here, is that he's going to have to stop being Mr. Nice Guy to everybody, wanting to please everybody, or you know, including people who find themselves in very problematic situations. One of the big criticisms that opposition kept on going on about him was that, hey, you've got all these smelly people inside there, but you are saying on our side. So whatever news he gets, whether he likes it or not, whether it's good news or bad news, and that's the advantage of being a second term president, Jeremy, is that you don't really you're not looking for another term. It's not like, you know, if you make unpopular, unpleasant decisions, that would really compromise you politically.
Right.
You might not, maybe not finish your term like Thabo Mbeki or something like that, but you know, you've got your second term.
Right. Well, no doubt a lot riding on this. Time is against us. Kevin Malunga, thank you very much indeed. Former Deputy Public Protector, now heading the law school at Regenesis Education.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A new study has laid bare the financial reality of many young South Africans. 82% earning less than 6,000 rand a month. Food is the single biggest expense, and many are simply skipping meals to get by. The Zaka Index, launched by Black Bullion South Africa with the Sanlam Foundation, is painting a sobering picture of survival over stability. I'm going to talk now to Tsepo Khapane from the software company Wafunda, part of the entire process, to discuss what this means for young people in South Africa. Tsepo, the Zaka Index showing 82%, as I've just mentioned, of young South Africans earning below 6,000 rand a month. This is not sustainable as a base, surely, for building any kind of future prosperity.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I think you're completely right. For us, it was a number that was quite alarming, because then you then ask yourself, how are people surviving in terms of food and transportation and data and all the other expenses that come in life? So it's definitely a shocking number for us, and it raised a number of questions as well.
Well, four in five respondents say they've skipped meals. That statistic reveals a lot, doesn't it, about the urgency of this crisis?
100%. I think it's one of the big pressures that, you know, young people are facing at the moment, including things like transportation, accommodation, connectivity. So something needs to be done. Young people need to be better supported. But I think it also speaks a bit about some of the existing infrastructure and opportunities that are there for young people.
What specifically are you referring to?
I think in terms of, you know, when we looked at some of our data, the amount of money that young people are spending on transport and specifically connectivity, you know, so, you know, a large amount of their budget is going towards transport, and then some of it is going towards data. And we know that data is important because it's critical for education, for job seekers, for social life. So, you know, something that some of us would deem as very normal, being data, actually is a luxury for some, and is super, super important for them.
So if it's ranked as a luxury, yet, as you correctly say, is essential for study and work, how should policymakers be responding to what is obviously a paradox?
You know, I think, Jeremy, you know, our policymakers need to be very aware of what's happening on the ground. So we did this study because we wanted to get a true snapshot of the way in which young people are utilizing their money. How do they feel about money? Where's their budgeting going? What are their thoughts and feelings? And what are the true decisions that they need to make? And I think policymakers need to be very aware of the realities on the ground and to start creating policy that speaks to some of these issues that are highlighted in the report.
You also describe, or the survey describes, young South Africans as resilient, but it's becoming a very tiresome word because for many, resilience is just another way of being forced to survive without any meaningful structural change.
Yeah, no, it's very true. I think, you know, despite the fact that these young people indicated that there's a lot of financial pressure, they're under stress, we did get some inspiring responses from them. You know, a lot of them saying, you know, they have hopes for a better future. They want stability. They want access to education and opportunities and to grow the existing income. You know, they are resilient, but they're also optimistic, you know, in the future. And so us engaging with them, giving them free access to financial education is our investment in that future, in that optimism, in that hope for a better future for them.
But if the current trend line continues, that optimism is going to run out very quickly if it isn't already.
100%. The report gives us a very stark and very real picture, and lots needs to be done. I think we're playing our role, but definitely government needs to come in, other organizations need to come in and to really understand what is going on the ground.
The index also says that most of your respondents cannot absorb a shock of 1,000 rand. That says a lot, doesn't it, about the fragility of savings and growth.
100%. And, you know, Jeremy, some of these young people are having to make very difficult decisions. You know, do you put money into an emergency fund versus money to eat now, money for transportation now? So, I mean, the research definitely shows how fragile this financial resilience is. You know, for many, an unexpected 1,000 rand expense could mean cutting essentials or borrowing or going without, which for us is a real shock, which means a lot of young people don't have those financial buffers. is, and they need to be able to plan, but to plan with what, which is a real reality for them.
So what you're also saying is that savings these days is completely off the table, also endorsed by the fact that food and transport are dominating budgets. It also tells us a lot, doesn't it, about the quality of work for young people and the wages on offer.
100%. It's very difficult to talk to young people about saving when there's so little that is there. So we need to address these issues. We need to look at how do we assist young people? How do we give them access to quality education and opportunities, and to really put them on a path to being financially resilient, but to also just be able to live and participate in the economy as well.
And if that doesn't happen, the risks are highlighting a lot in terms of South Africa's social stability. If, as we see from this report, young people are trapped in essentially a month-to-month survival mode.
100%. It is crucial that we look at the future of this country being youth, and we need to be able to assist them and to address some of the issues that they are going through. But these types of reports are important in bringing these things into focus and saying, when we're having conversations around policy, around the economy, where are young people? Are young people central in the decisions that we're making going forward as a country?
Well, that is a very worrying financial snapshot in late 2025. Tsepo Kgapane, thank you very much for talking to me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, last week, I don't know if you saw, there were new laws that came into effect that will change how e-hailing services like Uber and Bolt operate. E-hailing services, as far as I understand it, will now be required to be clearly branded, fitted with a panic button. Drivers have got to keep their profiles updated for accurate identification. So what does this mean in the broader South African context, where e-hailing vehicles have faced attacks from the traditional, so-called traditional taxi industry? In that respect, I'm joined by Justin Suttner, who's the General Manager for Aura Sub-Saharan Africa. Aura is the emergency tech platform that is powering Uber's in-app safety button. Justin, a very warm welcome to you. So these new laws require panic buttons and branding, as I've just mentioned. You also will tell me part of a bigger global trend. What is driving that?
Sure. Thanks. Nice to be here, Jeremy. Yes, Jeremy, the truth is that traditional public response services, your 911s globally, but bringing it back to South Africa, 10 triple ones, typically do not utilize technology. They're overstretched, and the capacity of the responses in terms of SAPS, your Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Services, are becoming quite a problem. And so what consumers now have access to around the world and in South Africa is an obtainable product and service in their pockets. And that is essentially driving connectivity, which meaning that more consumers have access to technology. And so what we're seeing is that government and public responses are becoming more and more stretched, which is essentially meaning they cannot get to the consumers in need when they need them. And so government is essentially playing catch up. And that is why we're seeing a lot of this mandated tech-enabled solutions in relation to how do we bring on the private sectors to assist.
All right, so let's get practical now. How does the in-app safety button actually work? What happens if I push it?
Sure. So Aura's essentially has a direct integration to Uber's in-app SOS emergency response feature. And what happens is that when a driver or a passenger activates that in-app SOS feature, it directly connects to Aura's auto dispatch platform. And then what happens is that a nearest vetted private response vehicle autonomously is dispatched and is able to navigate through our technology to the incident, be it the driver or the passenger, fully automated, fully reduced response times. And essentially, it's a seamless and integrated response once someone activates an SOS feature within the Uber application currently.
One of the concerns that I would have is that branding the vehicles could also make drivers and passengers easier targets, given incidents that we have seen before where such vehicles have been singled out.
Yes. So, Jeremy, look, it's a delicate balance. I mean, on the one end, you know, branding increases visibility and trust for the passenger. Very often you don't know if it's an Uber driver pulling up. So on one end, it's great for visibility. Unfortunately, the downside of that is it potentially makes drivers a more identifiable target to criminals. So it is quite a delicate balance. I personally believe it is something that's necessary, specifically in the consumer's mind, just to give them that peace of mind that, you know, if you're calling an Uber driver, that Uber driver is actually driving for Uber.
How difficult do you think it's going to be to enforce these safety measures and maybe even push it a little further? And let me ask you if regulators have the resources to monitor the compliance which is so urgently needed.
So Jeremy, I think compliance might take a little bit of time in terms of the regulators. You know, the policy is fantastic, but in terms of execution and oversight on compliance from a regulator's perspective might be fairly difficult. However, Aura's been actually in partnership with Uber for the last 7 years. So in terms of the two companies, Uber and Aura, coming together to offer their drivers and riders a safety in-app button that connects them to responders has actually been in play for quite a long time. So from my perspective, Uber's actually pretty well covered in terms of their corporate responsibility to their drivers. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it is a regulation that might be quite difficult to comply with. There's multiple areas that need oversight, specifically when it comes to the drivers and the vehicles and who is actually driving the vehicle. But outside of that, I think Uber's actually doing a terrific job already.
Is this added cost of new compliance going to push up ride prices, do you think?
Jeremy, I think that's a very good point, and I think it will. I can't talk on behalf of Uber, but specifically when it comes to physical panic buttons, you know, the cost of the hardware and obviously the service, you know, private security companies unfortunately don't respond for free. So I do think it will have a small incremental cost, but to be honest, I don't actually think it will be anything significant, and I actually think it will be welcomed by the general public at large.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Justin Suttner, who's the General Manager for Aura Sub-Saharan Africa. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this week, Africa is taking another big step towards shaping the future of artificial intelligence on its own terms. The Cortex Hub has launched the MCP Hackathon Africa. It's a continent-wide challenge, as I understand it, in more than 40 cities, all aimed at embedding African languages, culture, and priorities into the next generation of AI. Developer students and researchers, startups as well, are being asked to code the building blocks of digital infrastructure that will make AI truly local, with a final showcase in Cape Town in November. At stake is not just prize money, but the chance to influence how AI learns, speaks, and serves our communities. Joining me now is Andile Ngaba, who is patron of the Cortex Hub and also a driving force behind this initiative. Andile, let's start with a big picture, if we can. Why is this process not just about coding, but more about digital independence for Africa? Where's the deficit that we're trying to address?
If I take you back, I mean, I'll start on the telecom side. You know, remember when, you know, the early days of telecom, if you are calling anywhere in the world, your telephone is from Africa. Where will it go first? It will go to the country that is your master, i.e. from French Africa, it goes to France. From English colonized Africa, it goes to England, you know, and then your phone can go anywhere else after that. And even on the internet, for instance, when internet started, basically, you find that the major cloud and hyperscalers, they built the bulk of the infrastructure in Europe and North America. So when you search anything, even if you are searching something that is actually, you are in Johannesburg, you are searching something that a restaurant down the road, you know, you might find that you are going into Google search where that data sits somewhere else, not close by where you are. So the old telephone era to the internet era, We all got confronted by the same issues, basically. In essence, what we are saying is that as we enter the AI era, we cannot have this to again repeat in this environment. We need to create an infrastructure and an environment whereby building artificial intelligence infrastructure, we can be able to do it ourselves in the continent.
So,
for an example.
Well, let me ask you, before you give me the example, what's the danger if the continent doesn't move quickly enough to embed its own language and knowledge into these AI systems, which are moving at the speed of sound?
Gee, you know how people see the AI era. So there was what was called the space race before, you know, where countries of the world were basically in a race to go to space. There was another era during the Cold War, the era of nuclear power countries, where countries basically were amassing, you know, nuclear weapons. AI is seen in that light, that if you are not part of the AI environment going into the future, you will be relegated to what we call an AI failed state, meaning that your relevance in the 21st century, in the mid-21st century, will actually be not just insignificant, will be non-existent, basically. So that's how the world is going to be, for instance, in the era where we are going. So not just relevance, you will not be able to participate in the future economy, in the future, you know, geopolitics, in the future structure of the world, you know, if you are not going to be part, if you are not going to determine your seat in the future of artificial intelligence. Literally, you will be irrelevant. That's in essence what's going to be.
And in 2025, are you confident that we have sufficient skills to rise to that challenge?
That is why we are building this, amongst other activities, to almost Africa-wide in 40 cities, put together this hackathon of model context protocol platforms, which is something that really is one of the most important parts of artificial intelligence, because if you have an AI agent that has to go and verify anything anywhere, that AI agent has to interface with what we call MCP, which is the Model Context Protocol. Now, in 18 months' time, less than 2 years, there will be more than 10 billion AI agents in the world. You will have one or two AI agents, one for home, one for work, that you instruct to do your chores at home, and the one for work that does your scheduling, your appointment, and that does almost all the mundane tasks that you want your AI agent to do. If that AI agent has to communicate with the outside world, right, other than where you are, it has to interface with what we call the Model Context Protocol, which now these Model Context Protocol platforms will be spread everywhere in the world. They exist today. We do not have one in Africa as we speak, right? If, for instance, you are using either Grok or ChatGPT, or you are using Qwen, which is a Chinese, or DeepSeek, or you are using, for instance, Gemini, or any of the large language model platforms, and the information that you are looking for is real time, you are looking for a share price from company that is listed in JSE or London Stock Exchange, right? That large language model platform is going to send an agent. That agent is going to go and look for that information. Let's say in JSE, you're looking for MTN share price or Vodacom share price. It will then ask the Model Context Protocol to pull that data for you, either in the website of JSE or in the website of, you know, that company, and pull it back to the large language model where you're prompting, and in turn, it will give you that real-time information. So that's how important it is. So that is why we really are doing this hackathon, in order to make sure that entrepreneurs, businesses, big and small, across the African continent, really adopt this as soon as possible, right, so that they are not left behind.
Just right? Just a final question to you. How do you balance country competition or national competition against a more continental imperative, as you're suggesting to me? Because fundamentally, this is all about the economies.
It's all about the economy. So there's going to be, or there is rather, what we call, for instance, sovereign AI, where countries are going to build their own sovereign platforms, right? And if a country is delaying to do this, it will again be left behind. It will be categorized in what I defined earlier, right? All countries will build. So there will be these generic large language models that exist as generic platforms, for instance, but countries will be or are required or necessarily must have their own, for instance, you know, platforms in order to, one, promote their local languages, promote their own context, promote their own businesses, and be able to advance artificial intelligence in their own countries. Without a country to have what we call a sovereign platform, or what NVIDIA CEO, they call them national AI factories, you will be left behind as a country. So it's time is now, you know, for countries in Africa to be able to get into this train before they are left. The speed at which AI is moving is beyond anything we've ever seen in tech. So really, my advice is that, for instance, in the future, you know, this podcast, I might be talking to you, Jeremy, and yet it's your own AI agent that runs this.
Yeah, not quite, but maybe in time. Andile, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah. Andile Ngcaba, patron of the Cortex Hub, and as I said, the driving force behind this hackathon initiative. I appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.